Hi, Ken. Thanks for talking to us today at Classical IPR.
Great to be here. Thank you, Amanda.
You are the President Emeritus of UMS, which is the University Musical Society at the University of Michigan. For our listeners who aren't familiar with UMS, can you give us kind of a bird's eye view of what the organization is and does?
Well, UMS is the oldest of its kind in the country, the oldest university-related presenter. We got launched in 1879 when four church choirs in Ann Arbor decided to join together and form a choral union to sing choruses from Messiah. So our first concert was in December of 1879, and we've been going now. The UMS is starting its 142nd season. We were very lucky to have outstanding facilities built for UMS. The signature facility is Hill Auditorium, which opened in 1913. And it's big, but has great acoustics. When I say big, it had 4,200 people until just a few years ago when we had a renovation and restoration. It now has 3,600 people, which is, you know, half again. Well, it's 800 more than you'd find at Carnegie Hall or Lincoln Center. People come. I mean, people attend. There's been an audience developed over these 142 years, which is really incredible. And orchestras, recitalists, they just love it. And they love the facility. They love the audience. Horowitz played there 15 times. I mean, in a little town of Ann Arbor, to have Horowitz play there 15 times. We've had the Philadelphia Orchestra has performed in 268 concerts. Chicago, not quite as many, but I get you. I think, Amanda, you get the point.
Yeah.
We've been very, very lucky. And I mean, my predecessor was in the job for 30 years. The guy before him, 30 years. We who are in the job, we like it. We love it. And, you know, it's pretty special. And I'll just end with this, that we had the Berlin Philharmonic here a bunch of times, but in 1999, I got an email from the president of the orchestra, who's the guy is elected by the members. He was a string bass player named Peter Riegelbauer. And he mentioned five things that he thought were really special. One was the fact that it's we're the smallest town, but we deliver the largest crowd of any of the cities that they go to. And it's a fabulous hall. They love coming to Ann Arbor. Number two was, he said, you let us play Schoenberg, and you know, other cities are afraid of Schoenberg. Not only that, but your audience stood and cheered at the end of Schoenberg. And a third thing, we looked out in the audience and we saw a whole bunch of students. We don't see that any other place. Fourth, Ken, is that hospitality, not only what we receive backstage, but it's that letter in German on the bed of every single orchestra member when they enter their hotel room. And then finally, you know how to take care of our conductor, an ill conductor named Claudio Abbado. And then he reminded me, Ken, we've had 9 cities on this tour: Moscow, Bonn, Paris, London, New York, Washington, Chicago, and Boston. And Ann Arbor.
And Ann Arbor.
and all of these cities, you're the one we want to come back to. And okay, just one more thing to give you a sense of really how special this is Sir Simon Rattle was on his last tour with the Berlin Phil, and it was my last season. And I always go to pick up, the orchestra, and it happened to be him and me coming home alone from Willow Run Airport outside of Ypsilanti. And I mentioned to him as we were leaving the airport, I said, Sir Simon, I hope you know what a great privilege it is for us to have this orchestra come. And he chuckled and said, Ken, let me tell you, he said, when I joined the orchestra when we were planning our next North American tour, and the orchestra made it very clear, we begin our planning with Ann Arbor as a given. And so he was just saying, Ken, we love coming here. So that's probably more than you wanted to hear about about UMS, but it's a pretty special place. And then, you know, I'm succeeded by an Interlaken kid, by Matthew Van Biesen is my successor. And we had four things in common. One, we both grew up in the Midwest. We both went to Big Ten schools. He happened to go to your school, Indiana. I went to Michigan. We both play French horn, and ta-da, we both went to Interlaken playing our French horn. So, I mean, you know, when you get the guy from the New York Philharmonic, very successful there, and he'd been there for 5 years as president and CEO, to decide, I'm coming to Michigan, I'm coming to Ann Arbor, I'm coming to UMS. That's pretty cool.
Well, let's talk about Interlaken a little bit. We'll start at the beginning or near the beginning. You were a camper at Interlaken for 6 summers. What brought you to camp in the first place?
I started in 1955 as a junior boy and was there 55, 57, 58, and then 60, 61, 62. You just got to understand our family a little bit. My dad and mom, neither was a professional musician, but dad, who was a Ford Motor Company finance guy, he was able to get through Rutgers by being the accompanist of the Rutgers Glee Club. So dad and mom knew both the instrumental and the intrinsic value of music. This is good for you kids. So my three siblings and I, we all started piano in the second grade, and then we started instruments in the fifth grade, you know, when you start doing that in school. But they knew about Interlaken and how special it was. And so my brother Jerry preceded me. He came in 1954 as a junior boy. I followed the next year. And Amanda, it was the most important institution in my life other than my family as I was growing up as a kid. I mean, nothing like it. Kids coming from all over the world. 8 weeks away from home. Think of the relationships you can build. And indeed, this next summer, I'll be hanging out with guys I met there when I was 10 and 12 years old. And I'm still in touch with them. Transformative for me, not only in, you know, becoming familiar with the great music and theater and dance, but, you know, the repertoire that I picked up. You know, when I was in high school, we were playing and performing 8 different symphonies, one a week, but then we were sight reading a bunch of others. All these tone poems and things, the exposure to the repertoire, unbelievable. And then the friends that I've made that are lifelong friends, one in particular, you know, in 1961, I'd been there 5 years. I've been there, I think, 4 previous years. I was in my 5th year. And, you know, you're kind of looking around, who's here? And I think it was the first day of camp. I noticed this attractive woman. I found out she was a flute player. Indeed, she was playing second flute in the orchestra that I was in. So I knew she had some talent. And, you know, she had a lot of other things going for her. But by the end of the first week, I had met Penny Peterson from Mason City, Iowa. I asked her out for a date on that Friday night. She said, sorry, I have a date already. I was crushed. But I said, how about tomorrow night for the high school band concert? She said, yeah, I'm free. And that began a summer-long relationship before we went into our senior year in high school. And then we went to different colleges. I went to the College of Worcester in Ohio. She went to the University of Iowa. We had our ups and downs, of course, with a long-distance relationship. But by the time we entered our junior year, we knew this was it. We got married in 1966, had our honeymoon at Interlaken. I was director of transportation. She was typing the manuscript of Ken Doherty's Modern Track and Field. He and his wife were kind of the camp father and mother in junior and intermediate camp. He was an Olympic decathlon bronze medal winner, but one of the great track coaches of all time. And he had this classic book, Modern Track and Field. He was doing the second edition. This was before computers. And Penny was there typing the manuscript for Modern Track and Field while I was driving Kabalevsky and Eugene Ormandy and Kodai around. And you know, that summer, it was amazing.
Well, you also had a really interesting moment with Interlaken's founder, Joe Matty, when you were here during the orchestra's trip to Washington, D.C. in 1962. But Joe Matty didn't know that you were there for that moment. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this was fascinating. So I was born in Washington, and we lived there for the first 5 years, and we'd go back. So I knew the city pretty well. And here we were, the Interlochen High School Orchestra of 1962, having just performed for President Kennedy on the White House lawn. Of course, there was a big audience as well. We just had lunch, where I ate on the floor of the East Room with Kathy McNamara and Peggy Russ, the daughters of Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. And so the orchestra was on a little trip around town. They were at the Jefferson Monument. I'd seen it before. So I decided to just relax in the back of the bus. Joe Maddy happened to enter the bus, not knowing that I was there. And I just overheard him. He was talking to himself. Now understand, this was a real triumph to be invited by the President of the United States. And then the Academy was about to open in another month. And he was there speaking to himself, kind of dreaming and understanding, look, there's so much more we can do. I mean, I don't remember every word that he said, but it was Joe Maddy, as we can imagine, talking to himself, dreaming, what's next? And I was privy to overhearing that. I kept quiet. I didn't tell him I was there. But it's a profound memory of just who this guy was, because, I mean, any of us that know Interlochen can know Joe Maddy would dig a hole first, then he'd figure, now how am I gonna pay for this? how are we gonna, and that was just like Joe Maddy. But to have had that experience of both being at the White House, and having Maddy conduct that orchestra was so special. And I almost didn't make it. I mean, I'd been first horn the year before, got to play those great Brahms first horn calls in the last movement, got to play the solos in Liszt Lay Preludes, which, you know, that's the peak if you're a horn player.
Well, yeah, in case you forgot how it went.
then I came back the next year, and all these sophomores were so much better than I was. They cleaned my clock. I barely made it into the White House Orchestra, but what a thrill that was. Just so special. So I'm one of the lucky people that had a chance to perform under Joe Maddy, to really appreciate the magic of this man in his vision and what he was able to accomplish. And then having that moment of just overhearing a dreamer dream about what's next for us in this institution, amazing.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Ken Fisher, President Emeritus of UMS at the University of Michigan, and we're talking about his new memoir, Everybody In, Nobody Out. And Ken, I didn't think I'd be on the edge of my seat reading this kind of book, but there are some stories in here that are real nail biters. Let's start with one from early in your career about the Kennedy Center and the King Singers and the snowstorm.
My older brother, Jerry, now deceased, but, you know, an Interlochen kid. He was a member of he was in fact chair of the Board of Trustees for a while. He and his wife, Kathy, both love music. Kathy is a professional musician, but Jerry wasn't. They were with Ford of England, they discovered the King Singers, these six guys, choral scholars from King's College, Cambridge. They fell in love with those guys. They were just amazing. And when they came back from England, they shared recordings with my wife and me, and we fell in love with them too. Well, Jerry, with two other guys, decided to present the King Singers, along with Canadian Brass and a few others, just doing this as guys that were committed to Detroit, committed to Orchestra Hall, and amateur presenters. Well, they had a success with the King Singers. And I thought to myself, man, if they can do that in a recession-ridden Detroit, what could I do in Washington, D.C., which never has any recessions, and is a great choral town? So it's a long story, but I'll try to abbreviate it.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling.
I went to the I went to the Kennedy Center a year ahead of time and said, you know, how can a guy like me rent the Kennedy Center? And the woman chuckled and said, well, excuse me, pal, but your priority, she didn't quite say this, but she said, your priority is about as low as it can get. And I said, what does that mean? She said, Mondays in February. Well, that's supposed to be code for, pal, we don't have anything to do. Yeah. But I said, well, what Mondays do you have? And she said, well, we got the 7th and the 14th. And the. I said, you have the 14th of February available? Put me down. Put me down. Valentine's Day. I said, nobody goes alone to anything on Valentine's Day, so half of my marketing is done. she said, well, that'll be $10,000 before we talk any further. Well, I didn't have 10. I didn't have 5. I didn't have 3.
Wait, Ken, did you just dig a hole and decide how you were going to pay for it afterwards?
Well, Amanda, so, I mean, it's so interesting. So, you know, in a situation like that, I wasn't going to get anywhere. I said, well, tell me a little bit about you. And she said, now, what does that have? Oh, come on. I said, cut me some slack here. I'm brand new at this. She softened and said, well, I'm brand new at this too. Well, turns out she'd been up at Dartmouth College and had a divorce, was down here on her own. And I said, well, do you happen to know my little brother, Norman? He's been at Dartmouth for a lot. Norman is your brother? Norman Fisher, the cellist with the Concord Quartet? I know your brother. I love your brother. And she said, do you have $2,500? That would be it. And I said, I can come up with $2,500. So anyway, on February 14 of 1983, that's when we planned to do the concert. So two things happened that made it particularly challenging. We had a 20-inch snowfall 4 days before the concert on February 10. And Washington doesn't know how to handle one.
Yeah, I was going to say that our Northern Michigan listeners are rolling their eyes right now at the rest of this story, but.
Well, Washington didn't know how to handle 1 inch, much more than 20. It closed the town. I mean, closed the Kennedy Center, closed the government, closed the schools. I mean, Washington came to a halt. And, you know, if you're going to have a concert the following Monday, you're counting on that weekend to sell a whole lot of tickets. But the Kennedy Center was closed. We couldn't sell any tickets out of there. But I'd set up a kind of private box office, so we were still selling some tickets. Well, then it's Monday morning. The sun comes out a bit. Washington is still on liberal leave, the government, meaning, you know, if you don't want to come to work, you don't have to. The schools are still closed, but the Kennedy Center is gradually opening up. And so it looks good that the concert will happen that night. And then at 3:45 in the afternoon, the power goes out at the Kennedy Center. The guys have already arrived. They're on stage rehearsing when the lights go out. I talked to the guy running the Kennedy Center Concert Hall, Paul Zimmerman. I said, Paul, has this ever happened before? He said, yeah, only once. And the power was out for 24 hours. And so, well, God, it's 3:45. Do you think its concert's going to go at 8:30 tonight? He said, "Well, we'll see." Anyway, we were starting to get on our knees and praying that the power would come back on. And so, all the other presenters in the hall that night, we decided to meet at 6:15 to determine our fate. Everybody else canceled. Their events were at 7:30 and 8:00. Mine was at 8:30. So I said, "Well, how about another half hour?" And everybody else was upset. They all wanted to go home. The Kennedy Center staff wanted to go home. I said, look, I've been working on this thing for a year. Give me another half hour. If the lights had not come on at 6:45, it would have canceled the concert. The lights came on at 6:41, 4 minutes before I would have canceled the concert. And they stayed on. I put people at every door to meet, you know, that couple coming in for the poetry reading or the film or the opera. We'd be there at the door to say, I'm so sorry. You know that your event is, you are not aware that your event has been canceled. Well, you know, you can get a refund. You don't want to go back into 20 inches. No, get a refund here and go across the way and get a ticket to the one event in Washington that's happening tonight, the King Singers. So we sold over 200 tickets at the door. We ended up with 2,200 people in the house that night. The King Singers were magnificent, so good that every critic who was there, and they didn't have any place else to go, every critic used the word perfect in one of its forms to describe the concert. Amanda, that's how I began my professional career with a concert almost canceled, but with every reviewer we're using the word perfect in one of its forms to describe what happened. So that began what's been a wonderful, you know, almost 40 years of concert presenting.
Well, Ken, the title of your book is Everybody In, Nobody Out, which is a phrase from your mentor, Patrick Hayes, that has really guided your entire professional career. And this phrase manifested itself in many ways during your tenure with UMS, both in terms of what artists you brought to Hill Auditorium and to the University of Michigan, and what audiences you brought in. I was hoping you could tell us about Burt's Ticket.
Yeah. Okay, so I had the privilege of meeting, actually through Tova Feldschuh, a University of Michigan alum. See how that network works. I had a chance to meet Patty Asquith Kenner. And then I met her father, Burt Asquith, a University of Michigan alumnus, class of 1931, who in 1921, living in New York, he and the kids could not afford the train to get back home. So Burt decides, I'm going to charter a bus, which he did, cost the kids less, made a little money on the side, thus began Campus Coach Lines, a very well-known charter bus company in New York City that was founded by a University of Michigan sophomore named Burt Asquith. And Burt became a generous donor to the University of Michigan. He loved students, so he had something called Burt's Cafe. Imagine entering the undergraduate library and catching a cup of, you know, a cappuccino. And then there was Burt's Study Lounge right next door. This guy loved students. So knowing this, I went to him when he was 100, I think, and I said, Burt, tell me about the experiences you had at Hill Auditorium. And he went on about the artists he was able to hear, and he said, I loved it. I said, do you think every student ought to have that opportunity at the University of Michigan? He said, I do. And I said, Burt, what would you think of providing that one experience, that first experience of kids at the University of Michigan? What if we called it Burt's Ticket? And they went and all they need to show was their ID and they get a ticket. In fact, why don't we make it any first or second year student, because we've got some transfers. He said, I'm all in. So Burt gave us a grant that enabled us then to provide a free ticket to everybody. And I remember, you know, those of us in development, you ask for that first year, the second year, and then if it's successful, you ask for a 3-year grant. So I said, yeah. Burt was like 102. And I said, Burt, time for us to talk about a 3-year grant. And Burt looked at me and said, okay, call me tomorrow at noon. Now, this was after I'd written him a little proposal. He says, Ken, I'm 102. You're asking me for a 3-year grant. Make it 2 years, we got a deal. And so Burt's Ticket still exists at Ann Arbor. His daughter, Patty Asquith Kenner, has continued it beyond Burt's passing. But Burt got these wonderful notes from University of Michigan students saying, you know, Burt, thank you so much for providing me my first opportunity to hear some great music or to hear a choir or performer. So that's what Burt's Ticket is about.
Another initiative you took on was diversifying the audiences that attended UMS presentations, and particularly with the Black and Arab American communities in the region. And one person who was critical to this work was Letitia Bird. Tell us about her and what she did.
Well, you're right, Amanda. You know, when I arrived in Ann Arbor, we're housed in Burton Memorial Tower. I mean, quite literally and figuratively, a tower, an ivory tower. And I thought, man, with Patrick Hayes, you know, infusing me with Everybody and Nobody, I've got to get out of this tower. We got to build relationships with the diverse communities of shared heritage, with arts organizations, with other nonprofit organizations, with businesses, and so on. And so, in work that I was doing with the with a particular group from the community that was focused on supporting historically Black colleges and universities. So every year there would be a dinner in Ann Arbor with 600-700 people attending that would bring together the Black and the Caucasian Latin community. It was a wonderful dinner. And I served on the committee that helped sell tables and invite people to come. And in the process of that work, I met Letitia Byrd, a Black woman, I didn't know her at the time, but with a diversity consultant suggesting that the most important thing we could do at UMS if we wanted to diversify was start where you are. Look within your own organization. And here I discovered that this woman I was working with on this committee was actually a member of our choral union for years. She was attending UMS concerts for years. And when I put my hand out to her, she put her hand out to me and said, Ken, I know what you want to do to make UMS more welcoming to people, more diverse with your programming and your audiences. I can help you. And she did. And in 1997, in Ann Arbor, which is a pretty sophisticated town with lots of talented people, the Ann Arbor News decided it would start an annual Citizen of the Year award. And when Letitia Byrd won that award in its first year, you knew they were going to start right at the top. I mean, if you're going to start an award like that, you have to have a person about whom no one would object. And here was Letitia, who'd been a volunteer with over 30 different organizations, and yet she had not been embraced and engaged by this organization, UMS, until we had become aware of who she was and what a leader she was. And it was a real, it was so important for us to have had that experience to know that our auditorium had not always been a welcoming place. What we were programming didn't necessarily speak to the Black community. When you think that, yes, we've had Jesse Norman and we've had Wynton Marsalis and we've had Andre Watts, that's nice, but where's jazz? Where's gospel? Where is the African music? Where is the music that indeed speaks to the diversity of interests of the Black community? Then it was the same as we got out of the tower and into the communities. We built a relationship with the Arab community, where the largest concentration of Arabs outside the Middle East is in the Detroit area. And in our, until I got there in our first 110 years, we didn't have a relationship. And then there's the diversity of Asian populations and the diversity of, well, the Americas, Canada, and then Mexico, Central America, South America. And each has a really significant, important set of cultural expressions. And if you're in the business of culture, and you haven't a relationship with these communities of shared heritage in your own region, you gotta change that. And there was in 1982 a book, a management book called In Search of Excellence by Tom Peters and Robert Waterman. And a main thing in there was management by walking around. Get out of the tower and engage. That was the lesson for me. And of course, all of this is a tribute to my mentor, Patrick Hayes, who was critical in the desegregating of the theaters and the lunch counters of Washington, and who set a real example for me and so many in our country in what you do to embrace a community.
Well, Ken Fisher, this book reads like a who's who of classical music from the last 40 years. I mean, there's everyone from Leonard Bernstein to Wynton Marsalis to Cecilia Bartoli to Patrick Stewart and Jesse Norman. But just as important in the story are the people who aren't classical music superstars. We've already talked about Letitia Byrd, but another person who was crucial, at least to Cecilia Bartoli's success in Ann Arbor, was your barber. you tell us a little bit about that.
Well, sure. When you get out of the tower and into the communities, it's the restaurants, it's the banks, and it's the barbershops. I mean, building relationships wherever you can. And So I'm having my hair cut. It's, I think, 1992 in the Dascola barbershop. You got to understand, Dascola's 8 chairs on Liberty. All behind every chair is an Italian or someone of Italian descent. Dascola barbershop. These guys are from Sicily. So I'm getting my hair cut by Bobby Dascola Roberto. And on the principle that if you want to keep a secret, don't tell your hairdresser. I said, Bobby, I'm going to tell you something, but you can't tell anybody. Next year, I'm bringing the great Italian mezzo, Cecilia Bartoli, to Ann Arbor. Now, don't tell a soul. Of course, what Bobby did was he told everybody, which is exactly what I wanted him
well
to
played,
do.
Well played, Mr. Fisher.
By the time Cecilia was arriving, they'd sold a couple hundred tickets out of the barbershop, and they became, well, very special friends. We brought Cecilia by the barbershop in 1995. And right at that same time, a president of the University of Michigan had announced his decision to resign from the university. And as I was waiting to take Cecilia to a tailgate party near a Michigan stadium, I was waiting for her and I called Bob Dascola and I said, Bobby, I'm going to bring her by the barbershop. It's Saturday morning. You got a big crowd there. This will be, and she wants to see where you guys work. And then I called the Ann Arbor News and I said, if you think the big story in this town is the decision of the president to resign, you got something else coming. The big story will unfold in a few minutes at Dascola Barbershop. That's 2.5 blocks from your Ann Arbor News. You better get on up there right now. And so when I arrived with Cecilia, the place was packed with people. The Ann Arbor News came in and the front page of the Sunday Ann Arbor News color photo above the fold, Cecilia Bartoli with the Dascola Barbers. And above it was, for more on the president's resignation, see page 2. And then, I mean, the relationship continued. If you go to the Dascola barbershop now, you'll see there's a silver frame of a lock of her hair, photographs, all kinds of, there's even a life-size cardboard cutout of Cecilia. But that lock of her hair, what happened in a period of just about a week, the barbers, I was getting my hair cut at the barbershop, they all surrounded and said, Ken, an Italian barber really can't be in love with a woman without having a lock of her hair. I said, look, guys, you got the cutout here. You got the photo. I mean, you need a lock of her hair. And they said, Ken, yes. Okay. At the same time, the volunteers at UMS were putting together a really first-rate prize-winning cookbook and needed a recipe from Cecilia. And they said, Ken, we're holding up the publication now for a Cecilia recipe. And I said, perfect time to go to New York where she was doing a private house concert. I can leave with a lock of her hair and an Italian recipe of some kind. And so I saw Cecilia, who happened to be there with her mother. When I left, I had a little box with a lock of her hair and a potato gnocchi recipe for the cookbook. And I came back as a hero to my barbers and my volunteers. the cookbook is a terrific cookbook. It's called Bravo. It was a money, a fundraiser for UMS. And Amanda, there might still be a copy I could send up to you there.
Oh, I do love a good gnocchi. So.
Well, now, I would only say this, she's passed, but the recipes were all tested. And what I learned from one of the testers was, Jesse Norman's tea cake needs a little work. Jesse Norman's tea cake needs a little work.
Okay, but, we'll give her a pass. I think Jesse Norman was busy doing other things.
But there's Itzhak Perlman's bean sprout salad is in there. And Isaac Stern's hearty borscht. I'll send you a copy.
So, Ken Fisher, you retired, quote unquote, in 2017 from UMS. How'd you know it was time for the next phase?
Well, there were several things going on. One, any guy that's turned 70, when he looks in the mirror, folks are saying, Fish, you don't look that. But you kind of notice it. So one is, another is that my brother Jerry at that time was in hospice care with lung cancer. And you begin to think then, my dad had also died of cancer at 69. So you think about, boy, what else is there in life? And I was, our son had begun to have grandkids, bringing us grandchildren. Our son, Matt, who also an Interlochen kid who loved it there. And then, you know, there was sitting in the staff meetings, and I had a wonderful staff. And I began to be thinking, you know, the ideas, I used to have great ideas. They're not so great anymore, and they're coming and they're coming more slowly. And boy, if there's any sign that it's time to turn it over to the next generation, it's that you know, sense of, man, I used to have it, but I'm not sure I got it so much. And when there are great ideas coming from the next generation sitting around the table. And then I think the final thing was, you know, being the leader of an organization requires a whole lot of different skills, and you might get a sense, I really enjoyed being out there. I enjoyed being with people and with the artists, but there are also those responsibilities of, you know, the bylaws and the, you know, the performance review booklet and the staff handbook. That ain't for me, okay?
You don't love bureaucracy?
But somebody's got to do it. And you could hear the staff saying, well, Ken, we really need to pay more attention to the staff handbook. That's a sign of, you know, it's time for somebody else to focus on that. And so an announcement was made. I think the announcement was made about a year and a half before I would actually leave, which would be at the end of the 2016-2017 season. And what's so interesting is that I had met Matthew Van Beesen in 2011. He was identified as one of the top CEOs of arts organizations in the world through an organization called National Arts Strategies. And at that time, he was in Melbourne with the orchestra. Then he came to the New York Philharmonic right at a time when he and I wanted to start building a longer term relationship between the New York Phil and UMS. And I never felt, this guy's got one of the great jobs in the world in New York City running the New York Philharmonic. And I had no clue that he was really interested in maybe a change of pace coming to back to the Midwest. So when the head of the search committee called me and said, Ken, it's being narrowed down. We need you next week to be available when a top candidate for the position comes. And his name is Matthew Van Beesen. Man, I was so excited. I left the restaurant I was in. I ran down the street. I ran down another street till I could just, you know, control my excitement and have a further conversation with this guy. And then Matthew succeeded me. My last day was June 30th, 2017. His first day was the next day. And I am so happy with my successor, how he is managing the challenges of the pandemic. He has with him two of the people that I hired in the 1980s. And that was really my success, is I hired well and I hired really smart people. Three of whom I hired in the 1980s were able to be with me the day that I retired. So together, I think we had 114, 120 years between the three of us, four of us. That was the real difference. Hire well.
Well, the book is called Everybody In, Nobody Out, Inspiring Community at Michigan's University Musical Society. Just published this year by, of course, the University of Michigan Press. Ken Fisher, thank you so much for talking with us today at Classical IPR.
Well, Amanda, it's just great to, anytime I can have a connection with Interlochen and to have connected with you, another Big Ten University alum, with a great station and a great institution, I'm thrilled. Thank you so much.